Coming up today on Entrepreneurs Worldwide.
Shirley Bassey was rehearsing at 9:30 in the morning on the Albert Dock in Liverpool on a sort of cold, rainy day in September. And she had a fantastic celebrity meltdown, full hissy fit. My very first proper day as editor was the coverage of Diana's death. My father sold the family business for £100 million and has divided the money amongst his four children and gave me zero. Just so you know, I think we've got about 2 weeks of money.
Is there a part of you that quite enjoys those moments?
100%. Milf Manor became a massive hit.
Is the world of TV as we know it over?
Absolutely. What we knew is never coming back.
So, Nick Bullen, we are so delighted. Roz and I to have you here on our podcast, Entrepreneurs Worldwide. Thank you so much for coming. Now, Nick, you have been at the top of your TV game since 1990. You are the founder of Spun Gold Productions, a production company that I think everybody in TV knows hugely well. But what I'm interested in is you didn't start off like that. You started off sweeping the floor as a T-boy working for Granada in 1990, even on This Morning, was it?
Absolutely right. Well, thank you for having me, by the way. The September 1990, I wasn't even the T-boy. I was the T-boy's assistant on a show called This Morning with Richard and Judy.
Yes.
You all might remember that show. And obviously, you know, Richard ended up on it a lot. But I was, the T-boy's assistant. I was quite literally sweeping the floors and having made the tea. And on my very first day, they had Shirley Bassey on the show. And Shirley Bassey was rehearsing at 9:30 in the morning on the Albert Dock in Liverpool on a sort of cold, rainy day in September. And she had a fantastic celebrity meltdown, full hissy fit. I'm sure, Richard, in your time, you've seen these things happen. And in full hair, full makeup, full sequins, she stormed out of the studio and stormed up the colonnades of the Albert Dock, screaming, "Fuck off, fuck off," at literally everybody. And there was a researcher who I won't name.
I love her.
And no, she's fantastic, she was fantastic. There was a gay guy behind her who was the researcher looking after her in tight white jeans, running behind her going, Miss Bassey. She was screaming, "Fuck off." Richard and Judy were going, "What the hell is happening?" And that was my first day, and I thought, this is the job for me.
Do you know what upset her?
Oh, I do.
What upset her?
You'll know, Richard, you remember. So we used to do the rehearsals in the morning, the timings and changes. And then we'd have a live promo at 9:25. And Richard and Judy would live be going, coming up later on the show, you know, who's coming up? And you'd go live to the nation. And she would, Dame Shirley was rehearsing, and they started moving the cameras away from her towards Richard and Judy for the 9:25 promo, because Shirley was overrunning with her rehearsal. Shirley, being a professional, could see this happening and was like, what the hell's going on? And then at the moment they went live at 9:25, they killed the lights on Shirley, brought the lights up on Richard and Judy, and Richard and Judy started saying, coming out later on This Morning, and Shirley went nuts. And I promise you can hear it if you find the recording. You can hear in the background Shirley screaming, what the fucky hell, what's happened here, what the fuck, and then storming out and the door slamming, and she was just furious that they'd killed the lights.
Why would she care?
No one would do that to Shirley. You don't. You say, Miss Bassey, can we now take the lights down?
How old are you at this time?
Then I was 23.
So how have you stumbled on a job like that? What kind of background do you come from? Were you born with a silver spoon with your mouth? You seem far too nice. I'm sure you were.
I'm from Liverpool.
Yes.
And obviously over the years I've lost the Scouse accent. It can still be there when I'm drunk or aggressive. And I came from this sort of slightly weird family, actually, in that my mum was a very working class Liverpool woman from a two up to down in Liverpool, but she was incredibly beautiful. And incredibly vivacious. My dad was from a very wealthy sort of Liverpool industrialist family, and he fell for this beautiful working class woman. So I had this sort of weird mix, which I think has been somewhat of a superpower, in that I had that sort of thing of my mum's that I could talk to anybody, and I had my father's sort of confidence of a family with some money and some success and whatever. That was sort of my background, and the family business that my father ran had been going since the 1800s, and it's very glamorous. It makes colostomy bags, and it was a healthcare business. And obviously in the 1800s, it was making false legs. Now it makes colostomy bags. And it was a very, very successful business. But when I went into it briefly, I'm the eldest son. Every eldest son, every son since the 1850s has got into it. When I went in, I thought, this is not for me.
Why?
I just felt that it didn't fit who I was. You know, I'd had a little taste of television, because I did television briefly at This Morning as the tea boy before I joined the family business. I thought I should join the family business and do a proper job, and TV was just too much fun. But I went in and I thought, it's very shallow. I miss the glamour, I miss the fun, I miss the daily changing nature of a live TV studio.
How did you get from your father working in your father's company to the media?
So the timeline is, I finished my degree, I did a hotel management degree at what's now Oxford Brookes, and I went back up to Liverpool to get my stuff to come to London to try and get a job in television. Couldn't get a job at any company. I wrote in those days to everybody. Mm-hmm. Nobody even replied. I mean, literally nobody replied. And so I went to Liverpool. Rich and Judy had this show in Liverpool. It was quite new.
It was groundbreaking, wasn't it?
Very groundbreaking. There was literally nothing like it before. And I phoned up the editor's secretary, and I basically blagged my way in. And I said, can you let me come in just for a morning, just to see it? And that was the Shirley Bassey morning. And then I managed to persuade them that I could stay. And every day they said to me, you need to leave. And every day I'd come back. And in those days, Granada Television, who owned This Morning, was very heavily unionized. And I couldn't be there because I wasn't on the payroll. And so, again, absolutely true. I used to hide when the union rep came round so he wouldn't see me. And then I'd go back again the next day. And I just kept going back. And I did that for a couple of years. Then thought, okay, I need to be grown up and join the family business and do what all the sons have done.
Thank God you didn't.
Well, I went in for a bit, hated it. And then then Richard Madeley actually phoned me up.
Really?
Yeah, Richard phoned me up and said, I hear you're unhappy. And
fabulous.
I hear you want to come back to TV. Will you come back? And I was like, in a heartbeat.
Why do you think he called you?
I'd gone on really well with him. I'd gone on particularly well with Judy. And again, I think it's back to this sort of thing that I was saying with my mum, with this sort of working-class northern woman. Mm. Judy was a working-class northern woman. And I just knew how to sort of manage and work with and handle Judy. And Rich and Judy had just moved the show to London at this point, and Judy was really, really unhappy. And Richard needed to find people that Judy could connect to and had a relationship with. And so I came down to London and came back as a producer on the show.
Did you have something running through you that was thinking, I can do this, I've got a nose for a story, I know what's good TV? Did you learn that, or did you innately have that?
I think it's a little of both. I knew what could entertain people. I felt, you know, when you go into somewhere and you go, I get this. When I was in my father's business, I just didn't get it. In TV, I thought, this is where I fit, I understand it, I understand the process, and I think I know what entertains people. But to Rich and Judy's credit, they really taught me. I mean, what Rich and Judy taught me over the years, they're both amazing journalists. She's a particularly brilliant journalist. And they taught me how to really tighten the story. So anyone can have a good idea, but how you deliver it and how you can translate it into something that really does entertain is difficult. And I think Rich and Judy taught me that.
I'm going to touch on your childhood a second. So if you're growing up in an environment that's very much oil and water by the sounds of things, and you know, it's this theory of nature versus nurture, you've got quite an eclectic mix of parents, which I think is a very potent combination for creating quite an incredible individual, as you often see. You know, Richard's got a very similar background. What was your childhood growing up?
You've gone right to the heart of it very cleverly. It was a very happy childhood. It was a very loving childhood, but, and there's a big but in here, and you can see it. Mum coming into my father's world found it difficult. She had a broad Liverpool accent. She was a bit, as you say, oil and water with the whole thing. So she started drinking, and she became, I mean, now you would call it an alcoholic. You know, at the time, we sort of didn't recognise it, but she was a very heavy drinker who was using booze to mask her insecurities in that world. Mm-hmm. My father was an only child from a very privileged background, and didn't really know how to cope with all these sort of crazy, as he saw them, sort of female emotions and the sort of the booze and that whole world. So they stayed together, but it was quite a volatile marriage. And I'm the eldest son.
Yeah.
And I spent a lot of time trying to
mediator.
The mediation, exactly, trying to balance things. And particularly covering up for my mother. And, you know, I was very close to both of them, but probably saw myself closer to my mother. My mother was, you know, if she walked into a room, she knew everybody in the room immediately. You know, every restaurant in town, she knew the maitre d', she knew, I mean, literally everybody knew her and she knew everybody. But she was racked with insecurities. And I think I spent a lot of time trying to cover that up. And I think, back to this sort of learning some sort of superpower, going into television, you know, again, Richard knows, TV is full of fabulous but insecure people. And I think learning how to manage my mother has helped me enormously in managing talent in the industry.
Yes.
Business.
Yes.
When Richard brought me back,
yeah.
I was day producer.
Yeah.
The editor at the time, Richard and Judy, didn't like. And she just did not get Richard and Judy. She particularly didn't get Judy. Back to this northern thing. And I was, my northern roots do mean a lot because this editor at the time was a very southern, London-focused TV editor from the BBC who just did not work with Judy and just clashed. And so basically, Richard and Judy got rid of her. I wasn't even 30 at this point. And Rich and Judy called me up and said, "You're going to be the new editor." And I was like, no, absolutely not. I mean, I can't. I mean, I literally was just a day producer. And I was like, I can't do it. I'm not. There's no way. And they said, "Well, you're doing it." No discussion.
So they were actually, as presenters, they were running that show.
Oh,
it was their show. It was the first magazine show, wasn't
that was
it, of its time. And the reason I'm guessing is because they couldn't get the good guests up in Liverpool. Is that why they moved down here?
Partly. It was hard getting guests up to Liverpool, you know, because the guests had to normally come up the night before and stay overnight. Mm. If you're asking for sort of some Hollywood star to come into town, they're not going to fly to Liverpool on a Tuesday night to do the Wednesday show. So it was hard. But I think also Rich and Judy had done the show in Liverpool for such a long time. Richard particularly fancied coming to London, to the sort of heart of the show business world. Judy, I think, was less interested. I think Judy would have happily stayed in Manchester. But they came and, you know, Judy was very unhappy for the first 3, 4, maybe even 6 months. It came round and then we put a team around her that she felt sort of happy and secure with. And that's when I became the editor. And it was the summer of 1997. And suddenly, I mean, if you look at the cuttings from the newspapers in those days, this morning, as you say, was groundbreaking. People used to call it, you know, the litmus test of the nation's feelings because there were millions of people watching this every morning.
It was very relatable.
It was absolutely massive.
So I was made the editor. I ran it sort of over the sort of brief bit of the summer. Then we had a summer break. And then the thing that really popped for me, that really sort of made my career in many ways, was my first proper day of editor was coming back in sort of September 1997. I was now officially announced and it was... We were running it. We'd made this amazing show, and it was coming back from the summer break, the first show of the new season. And I got up on the Sunday morning and switched on the television, and I had a young baby at the time. It was up really early.
Wait a second, you had a child?
So, yeah, I got married. Okay. I got married in this. I met my wife, actually, my ex-wife, but my wife, we'd met on this morning. We had a baby.
What nationality is she?
She was British. She was British, and she was a researcher on This Morning. We got together and
researching each other.
Yeah, exactly. We got together.
As you do.
And I put the TV on, and Diana had died. Oh. Princess Diana had died, and I was like, "Oh my God, we now can't do tomorrow's show. The whole thing has to change." So my very first proper day as editor was the coverage of Diana's death.
Wow.
And if you remember that week, everything was changing during the week. So for that week, we were live every morning for, I think, 2.5 hours, and we were just following the story as it sort of evolved. But then what was fantastic was we suddenly realized we were beginning to set the agenda. In those days, we had a phone-in, and so the viewers were phoning in and saying how they felt. And suddenly, Richard and Judy gave a voice to the nation about what they felt about Diana. And that week of our programming was an enormous success. And that was what set my career. Because people suddenly went, oh, he's not just Richard and Judy's pet.
Did you feel there was an element of that within the industry?
Absolutely. Broadcast, our industry paper, when they announced me, said Bullen slips in as editor. And it was very much, it was slightly snide.
Slightly resentful.
Yeah. Richard and Judy have given him the job.
Yeah.
Which was true. They had.
Yeah. But what they didn't know was that you'd had a childhood that had been putting the special ingredients into you for a long time. And you showing up in that chaotic, slightly neurotic world was perfect.
But you've also, Nick, correct me if I'm wrong, also there'd be a lot of snide remarks, like Martin Frizzell, for example, who's just retired from This Morning. I mean, he is a journalist through and through. I mean, you're not a journalist by trade, are you?
No.
I can imagine the sniping and the griping that was going on. So you earned your stripe on that week, really, of Diana dying.
The
basically stood up and be counted.
Absolutely. It was, and I knew it. I knew this was the make or break moment. This was the moment that I could prove to people that I wasn't all Shirley Bassey sequins and hair, but that I could actually do proper stories.
Do you know, I think everyone to this day is still pissed off that Diana died.
Yeah.
At this point, are you motivated by money? Clearly not. I mean, where is the money coming from? It's just from the media. Did your father give you anything?
No, so again, spot on. The money was absolutely not the driver. If I'm really honest, and this is post quite a lot of therapy.
We've all had it, sweetie.
Not you as well.
From shamanic healing to you name it, I've had it all. The driver for me was proving my father wrong.
Yeah.
Is honestly what I think it was. So I'd done a little bit in TV. I joined the family business. It wasn't for me. I did a couple of years there. And then I went to see my father and said, look, we're not getting on. We're rowing with each other. And I'm going to leave. And my father said to me, if you leave, you get nothing. And you will have absolutely nothing. I was, you know, what, 28 or so at the time. I was like, fine.
Yeah.
I'm off. So I left. And I quite literally, he gave me nothing. I had a company car at the time. All of that went. Everything went.
Literally
everything. I was newly married. We had this young baby. And we were properly broke. I mean, no money at all. To the extent that my ex-wife was going to the pawnbrokers with her engagement ring to see if she could generate...
Fantastic. Cash. Gift of desperation.
Did you think that he'd actually do that?
I wasn't sure.
That's pretty brutal, Nick.
I wasn't sure. But you know what? And he may listen to this, I don't know, but you know, he's still alive. He's remained true to his word. So he's just sold the family business. He sold the family business this year. Yeah, this year. For £100 million. And has divided the money amongst his four children. And gave me zero.
No.
Zero, zero, zero. And you know what?
That must be very hard, actually, to process.
It was hard because of being the sort of...
You know why it's not hard for Nick? It's because he's worth 500.
Yeah, well, that's
why.
Yeah.
Maybe that was it. But you know what was really interesting was he had been so true to his word. I'd never really expected it to come. And what I've really loved is literally every penny I have, I've made myself.
Mm. Yeah.
And that, for me, was sort of the, you know, I'm nearly 60. That was the thing that made me think.
He backed himself into a corner. Now, the generation of today, our generation and the ones below us, they had the skill set to step out of that corner and actually redress themselves and maybe have a little word with themselves and maybe, you know, realign what's right and wrong and actually have an emotionally mature conversation with his son, which I'm sure deep down inside he'd probably want to do, but hasn't.
You must be very proud of you, what you've done. So you make a great success of being the editor of This Morning. I mean, that's amazing. So you're not paid peanuts for that, but it's not going to make you a lot of money, is it? It's going to give you a nice salary. How long are you doing that for before you then move on to Carlton TV? When does Spungold get set up, your production company?
I probably ran This Morning for about 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
They were probably paying me about £100,000 a year in those days, and they gave me a car. In fact, not even a car, I had a car. And it shows you how much money television had in those days. I was given a driver as well. You know, in my early 30s, I've got a driver driving me around London. I thought I'd hit the lottery. I thought this was amazing. I'd love doing the show. I was super, super happy. And in those days, there were four shows that you wanted to run if you were sort of at ITV. You was either Coronation Street, World in Action, This Morning, or do you remember Stars in Their Eyes?
Yes!
Those were the four shows you wanted to run. So I'm running one of the big shows of Britain.
Incredible.
Wasn't it Tonight, Matt?
Exactly, Tonight, Matt. Yes. Good memory.
Yeah.
And Granada was who I was working for. The other big ITV company was Carlton. And Carlton had had a huge fine for a sort of fake documentary that they'd done. So they'd cleared out all their staff, and they needed a new team to try and sort of restore Carlton and the reputation of Carlton. And I was headhunted from Granada to go to Carlton.
Yeah, you went to executive producer, didn't you? Yeah.
Where was Carlton based? Because where This Morning was, the old ITV studios, those were fabulous studios. Were those studios on the river owned by Granada, or was that Carlton as well?
No, Granada and all those studios.
Right.
Granada and LWT.
That's right.
This is the merge.
Yes. That's right.
Granada, LWT. Carlton was still its own company at that point, and Carlton didn't have studios. They bought Central Television and then took over the studios at Central TV up in Nottingham. But Carlton was, the offices were on Portman Square, and so we had beautiful offices there. And I got headhunted to go over there to run the factual entertainment department, and had, to be frank, my best boss ever, who was a guy.
I was about to ask, who was your mentor?
Yeah, he was. So Rich and Judy had been amazing, but then this guy called Steve Hewlett was the boss at Carlton at the time, and he'd run Panorama at the BBC.
Wow.
And this Diana thing keeps connecting. He'd done the Martin Bashir Diana interview, which is now, of course, infamous.
Yes.
But as the editor of Panorama, he'd had this. So he was a hugely respected documentary maker. And I ended up working for him. And I really didn't want to leave Granada because I was loving it. And he used a phrase, which again I've applied through my career now, which is fortune favours the brave.
And definitely does.
He said, come on, Nick, we have nothing. We're going to build this from the ground up. You need to do it with me. And it then slightly fed back to, you know, the entrepreneurs worldwide. It fed back to that entrepreneurial spirit that was in me from that northern family.
Yes.
Entrepreneurs thing. Mm. There is nothing here, and we can build this together. And I promise you, when I went in late 1999, early 2000, Carlton was on the floor. And nobody really wanted to work.
Why was that? Because there was no hit shows or what?
It had nothing. So it had this fake documentary.
Right.
The reputation
yes.
was in tatters.
Yes.
And it didn't have the big shows, you know. Granada and ITV, Granada and LWT had Blind Date, surprise, surprise.
Oh,
had
silly
Coronation
God.
Street. Had married Michael Barrymore with My Kind of People and My Kind of Music. All the big shows were with Granada and LWT. And you were crazy to be leaving them. This was mad to go to Carlton. But fortune favours the brave line that Steve gave me made me think, you know what? We're going to do this. And we went in. And we really built Carlton up.
Did you feel factual, obviously? Is that ultimately what runs through you? It's factual entertainment. That's your thing.
The key there is the factual entertainment bit. I was never massively taken by current affairs. I didn't want to work in the news, on the news desk. I didn't particularly want to make drama at that point. What I did like, though, was this broad brush of factual entertainment. At one end, you could be making a documentary about, well, then at Carlton. Do you remember Lena Zavaroni?
Yes.
Made Lena Zavaroni's documentary about her anorexia. So you're at one end, you're here. And then at the other end, I was making a show for Richard Desmond called OK TV, which was with, you know, a celebrity TV show. And I love that broad brushstrokes of it was all entertainment, but it was ultimately factual entertainment.
So do you then quite quickly start to turn this around at Carlton then?
Yeah, and Carlton really grew, and we started winning awards, and we started building, you know, getting sort of hit shows, and then very quickly, ITV decided to merge, and they decided to put Granada and Carlton together.
And that's why you jumped to go and start your own.
Is that when Spun Gold was born?
So
talk us through that.
So this is 2004.
Yeah, 2004, and Carlton and Granada merge, and I was offered a job back in the newly merged ITV. Running the whole of daytime. So, it was going to have everything. In those days, GMTV, this morning.
Wow, that's huge, Nick.
Yeah, and I was really thinking, oh, well, that's what I should do. This is the thing.
Are you still married?
Still married at this point. And I think we'd had a second child at this point. Again, another sort of little sort of bird in my ear, if you like. My father-in-law at the time was staying with us for Christmas in London. And said to me, are you going to go back to ITV? And I was like, oh, I think I probably will. He was also an entrepreneur, and he'd had quite a successful sort of digger business, you know, sort of Bobcat, you know, these little mini digger things. And he said, you know what, if you don't make it by the time you're 40, you'll never make it. And I was like, wow,
it's true.
That's brutal.
It's brutal, but it's very true.
But it's very true. And I was sort of, I guess, what is it, 35 or so, 36 or something like that. I thought, oh my God, he's right.
Yeah. He is right. On the whole, he is right.
He is right. So I thought, I'm going to have to do my own thing. And that was literally, with not much more thought than that, I thought, I'm doing my own thing.
So, but let me ask you this. Everybody knows today about production companies. Was it a big thing or was it a new thing?
There weren't that many at that point. I mean, it became the case that suddenly there were hundreds of production companies. But in those days, not so many, because you're absolutely right. You know, BBC, ITV controlled all of the output, really. Channel 5 didn't really exist as such. And Channel 4 was commissioning from production companies. It was only really a handful, actually. And yeah, Hattrick, you mentioned, was very successful in comedy. There'd be some one-man band, sort of current affairs production companies. But in my space, that factual entertainment space, there wasn't so much. And certainly making for ITV and the BBC, there weren't that many.
Where did you start? What, did you buy premises? Did you rent it, lease it? What did you do?
Well, again, I'm sure all of your guests have come on and talk about this. It was all front and black.
Yeah. Always is at the beginning.
And so, again, true story, I set up the company. I don't even think about it. I left Granada, or the merged ITV, with £40,000 redundancy. And I thought, well, that'll be fine.
Fantastic.
That'll be fine. That'll get me going.
Yep.
I had managed to persuade Katie Price, Jordan at the time, who was really famous at that point, to do a documentary series. And she had just come out of the jungle with Peter Andre. And it was Jordan and Peter were going to be living together. And I said, let me follow you living together. And I'll sell this as a show. So I sold to ITV the idea that I would make a documentary about Jordan and Peter. I had no team, no office, no production company, nothing. And the head of ITV at the time was a guy called David Lidermond, who'd been my boss years ago at ITV at Granada this morning. And he knew that I was a bit of a blagger. And he said to the commissioning editor, just check that Nick has got a team and an office and everything. And so the commissioner phones me up and asks the question. And I promise you, I'm sitting on the pavement outside Soho House.
Sir, absolutely swear I do.
Yeah, with my file of facts in those days. And she was like, you have an office, don't you? Right? I do. I've got a team. It's great. I've got everything. And she went, okay, well, we're going to give you 10 hours on ITV2 and six half hours on ITV1. Can you deliver straight away? And I'm like, absolutely not a problem. And off we went. And it became, to this day, ITV2's most successful show ever.
There's a theory that people always say, oh, he just got lucky. But the thing is that your wits seem to be so honed that actually you just saw opportunity everywhere.
I think that's really spot on. I do see opportunity everywhere. And I'm a big believer in, you know, you are offered a chance and you have to take it.
But you've got to keep going.
And, you know,
a lot of people choke, and that's what they don't understand.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And you know, what Richard was saying before about knowing about entertainment, I knew that people would want to see inside Jordan Peter's house. I just knew it.
Absolutely.
And I could sell that to someone if someone...
That's was. Having a nose for it. Was that one of the first fly on the walls of its kind like that? This is before TOWIE, right?
Way before.
And all of that. So that is the first show that Spun Gold gets commissioned.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm not asking what numbers are, but how does it work as a production company? So you go to ITV, they love the idea, and they commission, say, for example, 24 shows. We're going to give you £50,000 a show. You make it for whatever you make it, and then you just pocket the rest. How does it work?
You've got it. I mean, basically, it was £1 million commission, and The Sun did this big front page, because you're right, there was no reality stuff like that in those days at all. So The Sun is this big splash.
It's genius of you to think of that.
Jordan,
you know,
and £1 million reality deal.
It's brilliant.
And the whole thing is that it was a real moment. And you're right. ITV say, we'll give you £1 million.
Or do they ask you, how much is this going to cost to make?
Well, they roughly know. Nowadays, a one-hour documentary will cost you about £250,000. A reality show on ITV2, they'd probably pay £80,000. So they had a rough idea of the sort of slot price.
With a lot of these reality shows, a lot of people will go on these shows for nothing, right? Just to get the exposure. I remember one of my favourite clients of all time, Tara Palmer Tomkinson. I mean, her career was absolutely on its knees. And she was the first one to go out there in the jungle. And she came back and it was like the world was her oyster when she came off it. So it's a fine line, isn't it, with these celebrities? They want the exposure, but also they want paying for it at the same time. So how do you juggle that?
Everyone wanted to know whether it was fake. Had they just done this romance on I'm a Celebrity to sort of generate more cash for themselves? The truth is they did love each other. They were properly in love at that point. And so they wanted a fee, and it was a chunky fee. And again, back to this blagging thing, when their agent said to me, can you pay this fee? And I was like, yeah, we can pay the fee. You know, I had literally no money.
Sell the house, sell the flat.
I need this money. But the other clever thing, and this is, you know, Katie particularly was a smart entrepreneur. She decided she was going to own all her pictures, all her photographs.
Oh, so, clever girl.
Yeah, very clever. So she knew that if she could get this reality show away, it would up the price of all her photos as well. So there was a bit of a quid pro quo. We paid her money, but it also raised her profile. But you're right, you know, you get the money, or in theory, you get the money, and you then make it for as little as you can make it for, but it's still with good quality, and then you take... You know, your
How many hours a day were you working at this point?
Oh, then, because I had no team, we were working, I don't know, 14... 15 hours a day, because we were shooting, we were editing. It was a very fast turnaround.
Did you ever say to your wife, come and work with me?
Interesting. So she, we'd met in television. She had been, she was a researcher on This Morning. She then went on to launch the Vanessa show, the Vanessa Bell show. And then she was at GMTV for a long time. But by the time she had the kids, she decided she didn't want to sort of be in that sort of daily grind of TV. So she'd gone off to be a commissioning editor at Sky. And so, yeah, the idea of her coming across was never really going to happen.
Right, so you two were not seeing much of each other at this point.
We were not seeing each other at all.
Katie and Peter take off. So that must open other doors for you. So you are madly thinking of other ideas. But Katie and Peter, can you sell this around the world? Is that, that's what a production company is ideally looking to do, isn't it? Is to sell a show in different jurisdictions. That's where you're going to make the money. Is that right?
Absolutely right. So, you know, the guys that had Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, which is Celador, at the time it was called Cash Mountain, nobody was buying it. They had taken it to everybody, and nobody wanted Cash Mountain. And a friend of mine bumped into one of the guys that runs Celador, who said, I'm out of money. It's over. You know, we can't do this anymore. And then ITV, in that moment, stepped in and commissioned it. And, of course, it then went to every territory around the world, and they became multi-millionaires. So you're absolutely right. You want your show to go around the world. And there'd just been a documentary on Channel 4 called My Penis and Me, which was about men's relationship with their penises. And it had rated...
I was on that.
Yeah, I know. Well, wait. This has become a theme through my career, I can tell you. Because it did well. It did well. We were sitting in a development meeting going, what else can we do with penises? What else can we do with penises? There's got to be something else with penises. And someone in the development team went, well, and you've got to forgive me for saying this now, but someone just went, well, you can masturbate with them.
What,
and that's the biggest taboo. You know, nobody talks about masturbation. I mean, this is like a while ago, the early 2000s. No one talks about that. We should do a really shocking series.
What year was this?
2004, 2005. Wow. And we should do a really shocking series for Channel 4. And we're going to call it Wank Week. And we're going to do a week on masturbation, the greatest taboo.
I didn't see that.
Well.
We'll be scrolling later.
The reason you didn't see it is it became such a shocking thing for a public service broadcaster to be commissioning that there were questions in Parliament about it. The government was going, this is outrageous. This cannot be made. I mean, I promise you can find...
Britain was so different.
So it got banned, which, of course, was the best thing that happened to us. Because we'd made the shows by this point. And at the TV fair in Cannes at the time, MIPCOM, that year, everybody wanted it. Everybody wanted this band series.
Did they?
And we made a killing because everybody bought this series.
Of course.
Wank Week.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
But of course, look where we are now with Naked Attraction and all these different shows. That, I mean, you know.
Ours was so terrible.
So it's groundbreaking. Yeah. So you made a lot of money from that, did you?
That, because it, to your point, it sold around the world.
It sold everybody. Okay.
What is your largest ticket item to date?
It's tricky because it sort of probably falls into two categories. There's one, which was we made a returning TV show, chat show, with Alan Titchmarsh.
I was just going to ask you about that.
And it was called The Alan Titchmarsh Show, and it was 3 p.m. in the afternoon on ITV, and it ran for years and years. And so that made a lot of money, mm-hmm. and that really paid a lot of the bills over the years. The biggest hit in terms of cash was, and again, it shows you the low level of my programming. We made a show, a reality show for America called MILF Manor, and MILF Manor
What does MILF stand for?
You know.
For the people that don't know.
Mother, I'd like to fuck. And this is a terrible thing. I would tell you this very quickly. So my youngest son, again, judge him for this. My youngest son comes to see me and says, I've got an idea for a TV show. My friends and I have been talking about it.
Good for him.
And it's a show where young guys date older women. And for years, older men have dated younger women. So why can't older women date younger men?
Yeah.
I was like, darling, it's a great idea, but it's a bit so what? You know, come on. He went, no, daddy, you haven't listened to me. The actual twist here is we send a group of really hot mums to a villa or island to date the young guys. But when all the young guys turn up, every one of those hot young guys is the son of one of those women.
Brilliant.
So suddenly,
brilliant.
You're dating in a pool of mums and
men. Oh, loving it.
And Milf Manor became a massive hit.
Did it?
It was called, I think the American papers called it the worst reality TV show ever. Rolling Stone called it incest porn. I mean, it was dynamite. But that was a big ticket for us.
What is your favourite you've ever shot? Or your proudest? What is the one you're proudest of?
Oh, that's so hard. We're really well known for live events. So we do big live
Yes,
events.
You did the role...
The BAFTAs.
The Queen's.
We did the BAFTAs, we did the Queen's 90th, yeah. And that's probably the one. The Queen's 90th birthday celebrations. It was a massive honour to make. It was a huge, huge event. And it was a weird moment in which my sort of life went sort of full circle because Shirley Bassey was on the show. So all those years ago, Dame Shirley on This Morning years ago, she's back on the Queen's 90th. And the Queen's 90th was incredible, and it ended up winning a BAFTA for being the best live event of the year. And the Queen was very heavily involved in sort of developing it with us.
How do you start to end up being really known now, which is what you are for many things, but for making royal programmes?
I think, you know, look, you do it brilliantly, Richard. It's being... You've got to be good at the job, you know, clearly. But they've got to know that you are also... discreet.
I've just realised something about you. You have integrity.
Well, I think that's it. And I think, yeah, Richard has it.
He does. In space.
What, integrity? Yes, making he does. Programmes of MILFs and sons.
I can say, Richard has it. I'm not sure I have.
No, but he does to come it. On your I next series of MILFs and sons, exactly, by the way.
Exactly. Don't you dare.
But it's true. They know there's a level of trust there. And we made a documentary. We make a lot of royal documentaries and a lot of royal TV shows and a lot of royal events.
Are they what I see on Channel 5 a lot?
So we don't make those ones. Mainly what we make are the royal shows with access. So we're with the King or the Queen or, you know, the Prince William or whoever it may be. So Camilla has only ever made 3 documentaries where she's given full access to herself, and we've made all 3.
Wow.
So I struggle with Camilla. It's the one I really struggle with.
Oh, no, do you know what? I like her. She never expected to be in this job, and she does it.
Oh, I think she did well. Expect to be in the job.
I think she expected, she hoped to marry the Prince of Wales, but I don't think she ever thought she was going to be Queen. I think she has a sense of duty.
I suppose you can't blame someone if they fell in love with someone.
Well, I'll tell you again. When we were making the first documentary with her for her 70th birthday or 75th birthday, I can't remember which one it was. It was the story of how she got to this point. The truth of it is, she fell in love with 2 men. She loved this dashing army officer, Andrew Parker Bowles, and she loved Prince of Wales. And she was genuinely in love with both of them. And she could never marry the Prince of Wales because, to be frank, she wasn't a virgin and she wasn't aristocratic enough. So it was never going to happen. So Andrew Parker Bowles was the right one to marry, as much as she may have hoped that it might be the Prince of Wales. And so she had to accept that she would never be with the Prince of Wales, ultimately. Andrew, of course, was a very famous swordsman, as we know. Mm-hmm. And when their marriage fell apart, when he became famously cuckolded and, you know, they had to go, her friend has told us this story, which was that she, at that point, thought, wow, how have I reached whatever age she was then, my mid-50s or whatever, and I've lost the 2 men that I actually loved, because I can never be with the Prince of Wales still at this point. And Andrew's had to leave because he can't be the most famous cuckold in Britain. I'm now on my own. And that, for me, was a moment that I thought for her must have been incredibly difficult, mm-hmm. when she only ever really loved 2 men. And now at this point, she can't have either of them. Mm-hmm. And Diana was still alive at this point. For me, that was a turning point with Camilla. I thought that must have been an incredibly dark place for her.
Were you filming her at that time? Is that what you're saying? You had access
so
to
we weren't filming when that all happened. Right. This is when we did her 70th birthday filming.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you're incredibly manipulative.
Entrepreneurs Worldwide with Thompson Tindall.
What you've got with Thompson Tindall is a boutique, very specialised wealth management company. And a company that I trust implicitly. And I've been with them 6 or 7 years, and he has done wonders with my money.
Entrepreneurs Worldwide with Thompson Tindall, getting a grip on family wealth protection.
Please note the value of your investments can go down as well as up, so you could get back less than you invested.
So the Alan Titchmarsh Show, which I was very lucky enough to be on quite a few times.
Loved having you on it.
I loved being on that show. And are you behind the one on Sunday mornings now?
Yes.
So do you have this history? So basically, most of what Alan does, he does with you, does he? Is that you've just got this great relationship with him. What I didn't know is what an unbelievably intelligent, consummate, incredible presenter that man is. I had no idea until I actually saw him do that live. And that show on Sunday morning, if you're behind that, Nick, I didn't know if you were. That's like having a comfy pair of slippers on. Just the sort of thing that you want to watch under your duvet on Sunday. I would imagine that's hugely popular.
Oh, massively popular.
Was that your idea?
Yeah, so we came up with that. So my business partner is a guy called Lee Connolly. He runs the Penny Lane label. And Penny Lane makes Love Your Weekend. And yeah, we've worked with Alan since probably 2006, 2007. And we've made all his shows, whether it's his gardening shows, his chat shows. And you're right, he is one of the best presenters in the UK. He's certainly one of the best presenters I've ever worked with. We shoot Love Your Weekend down in a little farm in Hampshire, in a barn. We have no problem booking guests because people want to come to chat to Alan. But again, you know, these are these sort of moments in life, you know, to your entrepreneur's piece, that are sort of seismic. Alan, for me, was a seismic moment because I had set the company up in 2004. It was going amazingly. We were flying. We'd had Jordan and Peter. We'd had the Bank Week stuff, and everything was getting crazy, and we were killing it. And in 2006, after 2 years, I thought, this is easy. We're making money hand over fist. But then there was the financial crash.
2008.
Yeah. And the world just
stopped.
And suddenly the advertising finished. We had no money. We were done. And I'd just bought a big farmhouse up.
What, you thought Spungle was done?
Oh, yeah. We just bought the big farmhouse in Suffolk. We were living out there. We'd got the horses. We'd got the dogs. The kids were, you know, their little prep school. Life was flying. I got to a place where I had 2 weeks of money left. That was it.
Fabulous. That'll wake you up.
I know. And I went for a walk with my wife and just said, look, don't worry about this. I will sort it. But just so you know, I think we've got about 2 weeks of money left.
Let me ask you something. Be honest. Really ask yourself this. Is there a part of you that quite enjoys those moments?
100%.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I think this is my... Honestly, I think it's when my father cut me off and said, you've got no money, I was like...
That's a hell of a challenge.
That's such a brilliant question.
Thank you.
To ask. You know,
it's true, though. I can see it in you.
Yeah, that's really good.
Yeah, and it's true. And I've been there again since. And
he's going to give you your own show,
buddy. No, you should.
I tell you what,
you're really good. You see things straight away. You go like, every question you've gone, is it? What about this? And you know, I can see why Richard's with you.
He's taught me everything.
The MILF side of it. That's what
exactly.
No, he's with me because of the MILF.
Exactly. I'm not saying anything. But no, I just went for a walk with Zoe, my ex-wife, and just said, look, 2 weeks of money left. I will sort it. And I genuinely knew I would sort it. I had no idea how. That day, I get a phone call from an agent called Annie Sweetbaum. Do you remember Annie?
Yeah.
And Annie, you would love. Annie is the agent from Central Casting. Big blonde hair, huge diamonds. She used to be an actress. She's just amazing, and I love Annie. And Annie had been Rich and Judy's agent all those years ago on This Morning. And I just kept in touch with Annie over the years. And I'm quite good at seeing people and, you know, just keeping up with people. And I love Annie, and she's 82 now, and she's still one of my best friends. Anyway, she calls me and just goes, darling, Alan wants to leave the BBC. And I thought you'd be good with him. I thought you should give him a chat show. And I had literally just had this walk with Zoe. And I said to Annie, do not go anywhere. Do not do anything. I will make this happen. And I phoned ITV and I was like, Alan Titchmarsh wants to leave the BBC. We need to do a chat show with him. And Annie had already slightly teed up the ITV to this point as well.
He's a gardener by trade, right? But he hadn't really done a proper chat show like what you gave him, right?
He'd done his gardening shows. Ground Force had been the big hit.
Yeah, and he led that, didn't he? But it wasn't a chat show.
No, he'd done a bit of stuff on Nationwide.
Yeah.
He'd been a bit of a presenter on Pebble Mill. But he'd never had his own show.
Yeah, this is a proper own show in the afternoon.
Amazing.
And this is back to spotting the things, like spotting Jordan and Peter, like spotting sort of what
you... Well, I'm amazed that you managed to convince ITV that he could hold a show like that in the afternoon. At that, so of course, he went on to prove that he can hold more than that. But at that time, that's quite something to sell into ITV,
he was,
right?
One of the selling points that we used, and again, true, is... he was so popular with women of a certain age, who was that audience at sort of 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And at the time, his waxwork in Madame Two Swords was the most kissed waxwork.
Was
in
it really?
More than Brad Pitt, more than any of those people.
I suppose they're all married to a man like him.
Yeah. And this is it. And yeah, he's an earthy, rather nice, you know, accessible.
He has good British
values.
How
long did that go on for?
Oh, wow. That ran for years. That ran for, gosh... 5 years or something, and we were making, you know, hundreds of shows a year.
So have you and Zoe ended up on good terms? Because it sounds like you both went through a hell of a journey together.
We were married for nearly 27 years, and we were better friends than we were husband and wife, to be honest. And
well, it's hard. Think about it. It's hard to be a husband and wife when you're building companies and you're living on shoestrings and you're almost losing the house, not losing the house. You've got one crisis to the next. You know, you're facing precipices. You're basically living a cliff jump. Jump off the cliff, solve the problem 3 seconds before you hit the ground and repeat.
You've also got the pressure, the financial pressure. You're trying to build
it's
something.
Awful,
you've got
actually.
Children's school fees to pay
back
for
in
and
horror.
All of that. You know, it's like Ros and I starting this now. The lovely thing about this is that nobody's got a financial gun to our head. You know, this is just pure joy for us.
Yeah, we've also learned to communicate. I think that's a big thing. I think when you first start off in a marriage, and particularly when you're building companies, communication is something you have to learn as you age. And if you come from families that don't communicate like yours and mine and Richard's, it's very hard to suddenly be thrown into, you know, it's easier to work than it is to deal with intimacy or communication and actually know what to do in that area.
You're too good, by the way. You are too good. Because that is... Absolutely. You just laid out 27 years of my marriage there.
Yeah.
I think sometimes the success is actually the very thing that kills you in the end.
I'm okay about jumping off that cliff and solving the problem 3 seconds before we hit the ground. Zoe found it very uncomfortable. You know, that she didn't like the sort of the roller coaster so much. And I think she found that difficult. And I think when we were doing sort of marital therapy about, you know, trying to keep the marriage together, the therapist, who was amazing, sort of said, you know, I'm speaking French and she's speaking German, and we're probably both saying the same thing, but we just don't understand each other. And that communication was a real issue.
And rightfully so, because no one really should have to exist in that environment, a chaotic, extreme environment. But the thing is that is the entrepreneur's life. Now, your relationship now, you have a new relationship. Would you say that you are able to show up as a better man? And I don't mean a better man. I mean a man that's able to be intimate in a different way now.
If you ask Christina, who Richard knows, Christina will tell you she is benefiting from all my years of therapy. Because it's true. I think I've learned how to communicate much better. You know, she's Swedish, my girlfriend now, and she's very direct. And... if she doesn't like something, she makes it very clear to me. I think I am a better person for the journey that we've been on, the therapy that I've had, and also the sort of all the near misses. When the near misses come now, which they still do, I think, you know what, I'll probably be
Absolutely. I think Ros and I both said, I mean, we're all, in fact, Nick and I think we're exactly the same age. Ros is a little bit younger than me, but we've all been through long marriages. And I just think to myself, if we've all been through this and we've got children that have had to suffer for it, we've got to come out of those situations having learnt something.
I think the ability to be present in yourself is something I can do now. And I look back.
You're brilliant at that.
I am, but I've had to learn how to do that because I lived a secret life in my marriage where there was a door that no one went through, and that door I couldn't even open. And then when I met Richard, he blew the door open, and I couldn't understand how he could do that. But it's so nice to not live a life now where I'm truly myself now, rather than spending decades as this other person.
Again, you're good. One of the things that I discovered sort of in some of the therapy that I was doing, and I saw a shamanic healer, because I'm obviously ridiculous.
Yeah, we'll do anything to find answers.
Well, you know, yeah. So anyway, she was really, really interesting. And she talked about how I was just constantly building. We talked earlier about, you know, I like building things. And clearly I do, because, you know, the house in Suffolk, I was constantly building there. I was making the garden better. I was making everything was just building the business, building the garden, building the house, building this, building everything, building. She said to me, have you stopped to see where the door is, where you let people in?
Mm.
And I was like, oh. And she said, just look at what you've built. She said, you've built this amazing thing that you look out of and you see this great business, this sort of, you know, hopefully good career, you've built a beautiful home, you've put your children through amazing schools, you've built all of this, but you are not letting anybody come into it. And it was a really striking moment where I thought, God, she's right. You know, I was so busy running forward and building that I hadn't stopped to open the door and say, to anyone, come in.
Yeah. Wow, that's really profound, that is.
Actually, I'll just stop there because he is a man that I have never experienced before. I grew up and I experienced in my work life nothing but men. I was pretty much the only woman everywhere I went. And then I met Richard. I have never met such a present, honest with his feelings, emotions, his thoughts. He is completely and utterly present when you communicate with him. And actually, that is my ideal masculinity, because I think a lot of men's masculinity is wrapped up in what they do, and they can get a little bit lost in that. But actually, the true strength of masculinity is actually a man actually able to be present and actually make good with the child he was once and the man he is today and actually own that. You're a very good testament to that because I can see it and feel it, but Richard is quite remarkable in his masculinity.
I would agree. Let me just keep carrying on with that comment. I would absolutely agree with you about Richard. And I think one of the reasons that Richard works so well on television and, you know, I'm sure in your day job as well, is people feel it. People, certainly on television, people see the authenticity. The camera spots it straight away. And, you know, we talk about Alan Titchmarsh. If you meet Alan in real life, the bloke that you've seen on the telly is the same person. And I think that's the thing about Richard.
100%.
You see Richard, whether he's the big star in the salon, on the television, or in the street. And people see it.
Do you know, we go to parties and I'll look round, and before I know it, there's like six people under one arm, six people on the other arm, and it's Richard in the middle, and then there's people all around him. A man's journey in life is to actually become and meet the man in the mirror and actually make good with him. And I think it's that transition that is so vitally important.
I think you're absolutely right. I think looking in the mirror is really, really hard.
People always say to me, oh, well, it's because you do what you do. That's why you're good at that. See, I can talk to a woman like a gay man can. I honestly can.
Yeah, I know you're brilliant.
And that's not me chatting them up. Yeah. That's just because I'm just an open soul. And I think, funny enough, one of the producers on Lorraine, she wrote to me on an email, and nobody, they never really give you any feedback on This Morning or any of these shows. Nobody really does. She said, do you know what? There's a lot of celebrity hairdressers that we have on this show, but nobody does it like you because nobody relates to people like you because you are just you. Mm-hmm. And that's it.
My Swedish lawyer girlfriend needed to see a hairdresser in London, and I immediately said to her, go and see Richard. She's a tough old character. Tough young character, thank you. And she just fell in love with Richard.
Yes.
Absolutely fell in love. And she said to me to say today, and I'm going to say on the podcast, she said to say that you changed her life, because this is a woman who hid behind a sort of messy bun, all pulled back, and Richard persuaded her to drop the hair down, and she'd never... ever done.
She's a beautiful looking woman, though, isn't she?
Well, I think so.
No, she is.
You made her do it, and she now goes out, and people go, oh my God, you look amazing. And that was Richard that did it, and she had a trust in Richard that would allow her to do that. And all credit to you. That's, and again, you can't learn that.
No, you can't. No, but I think you two have very similar mothers, both charismatic, life and soul of the party, able to mix and blend with all types of people. How did your mother end up?
Sadly, she died quite young. She, you know, booze and fags got her. Yeah. And she died in her early 60s, and she got cancer. She was diagnosed in the June, and she was dead by the October. But to her credit, I said to her, what do you want to do? And we talked about communication. Nobody wanted in my family to talk about this. You know, she was dying. She was clearly going to die, and she was going to happen.
You've got to
quickly talk,
yeah.
And no one would talk about it. So I said to her, what do you want to do? And she said, I want to go on holiday with the family, and I want to have a party. So my parents had a house in Mallorca, so we went to Mallorca with the family, and that was all very nice. And then we organised this big party at home up in Liverpool, and she had a huge marquee. Everybody turned up. Amazing party. She was very, very ill at the time. Had this amazing party. But then she got into bed that night and didn't wake up.
Oh, wow.
She'd literally said goodbye to everybody and just didn't wake up the next morning. And I was like, that is a way to go. So she lived her life very fully, but it was just, it was a proper thank you and good night.
Yes.
Well,
good for her.
Yeah.
So I just want to ask you, there is a question that we ask all of our guests at the end, which we will come to, but I just do want to ask you this. Let's take you back to the world of TV. Is the world of TV as we know it over?
Absolutely. Linear TV, so for your audience, linear TV, you know, the traditional ITV, BBC, Channel 4, NBC or ABC in the States, any of those, it's over. What we knew is never coming back. And I was in America a couple of years ago, and I was talking to a producer there who I really respect, and I was slightly moaning, still going, oh, we're not getting any work, and the traditional commissioning has collapsed. And he said to me, you have to stop complaining. You've got to shift. You've got to pivot. And he said, it's just the evolution of entertainment. You know, when the music halls were huge, they ended when the silent movies came in.
Yeah.
Silent movies ended when the talkies came in. Cinema had a big problem, if you remember, when video came in. Video had a big problem when streaming came in. And that's where we are now.
Is there money for you to still make?
Well, again, it's back to this fortune favours the brave. In the UK, you can make money in two spaces. You can do the inexpensive, long-running daytime shows, like Love Your Weekend with Alan Titchmarsh.
Yeah.
Sunday morning stuff. You can get a reasonable market if you're making 9 p.m. drama or reality shows, you know, Love Island or Love is Blind or whatever it may be. But if you want to make proper money, you've got to be on the streamers. You've got to be getting your business to the Netflix, the Amazons, the Disney Plus. So those, you know, we were talking earlier about the global market. You have to now play globally. But it's really hard because you go to Netflix in LA to pitch a show and you're in there pitching with Australians and Koreans and Americans and Spaniards and Germans, and you're pitching against the world now for a limited number of slots. So there's money to be made, but it's super hard, and you've got to have that determination that I will break through and I'll get something away. Drama, I'd say drama and reality are the two big areas that are doing the best. You know, look at the way we all consume TV at 9 p.m. You'll binge a box set of drama or you'll binge a reality show. But the other big area, and you know, we're excited about this and we've set up a company to do this, is social media. You know, YouTube now...
Talk us through that.
Well, yeah. YouTube is the biggest commercial channel in the UK now.
Yeah.
Bigger than ITV, bigger than Channel 4. It'll soon take over the BBC.
Yeah.
But the model is really different. You go to ITV, you pitch a show, they pay you the money. Now, at YouTube, you have to take the risk. You guys are doing it with Spotify, you know, with Apple Podcasts, with
YouTube.
You've got to take the risk. You've got to make the show. You've got to.
Do you know, Nick, I noticed the other day, the CEO of De Vere out in Dubai has his own YouTube channel. Yeah. They're all going to have to do it.
Yeah,
I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It is the future, and you have to look now at how you can monetize your content. So I think for me, and you know,
Now, how would you set about doing that? Because there'll be people listening, you know, facing quite daunting times with the AI coming up. You know, there was this young person the other day said, well, you guys know how to be entrepreneurs because you've always done it. But the young people have to use AI in their minds to become entrepreneurs, which is not the case. But let's just go along with that for a second.
Well, I'd say there's two things. I think, you know, I don't call myself a television producer anymore. I'm now a content producer. So I produce content for any platform you want, in any sort of format you want. But I still think it's back to spotting what entertains people, what's a good story, and can you tell a story well? So, you know, you guys, super smart with this idea. You know, this is a good, interesting concept for people to listen to. So you feed into that. At the other end, there's a guy called the Hoof GP on YouTube. I don't know if you've seen him. He is...
For horses?
No. There's the Hot Farrier, Sam the Hot Farrier, who does the horses.
Yeah. Things.
The Hoof GP is a guy called Graham in the Borders. And he does cow's hooves. He is making...
I've heard that.
Oh my God. He is making so much money on YouTube. He shoots it mainly on his iPhone. He's got an assistant shooting it. He shoots his life. It's back to being authentic. He's a real hoof GP. He really does do cows. He's a very nice guy. He's sort of quite good looking. You know, he's handsome, sort of early 40s. I met with him because I'd like to try and sort of do more with him.
Yep.
He's making so much money that he's just bought him and his wife matching Lamborghinis.
Who's paying him that? What is it, per click? How does it work?
Yeah, so he shoots his content.
Yeah.
He puts it up onto YouTube yep. and onto TikTok and onto Facebook and on, you know, and it's and he is being paid per click and then bringing in sponsorship as well.
And bringing
we watch this mowing person, this person that mows lawns. So they take in Detroit, you know, places yeah. like that. It's a backyard that's an absolute mess. And the guy comes in and he mows. And mows and mows, prunes and prunes. And Rich and I will watch for ages, just mesmerised.
Yeah. There's an amazing girl in China called Lizzie Q. Take a look at her. Lizzie Q is very beautiful and she cooks things. And all she does, there's no voiceover, it's just beautiful music, beautiful pictures, and she chops stuff and the sound of the chopping and the sound of the frying and then the sound of the sizzling of the pan. I promise you, half an hour later, you're still watching this. It's going, oh my God, it's amazing. Millions and millions of followers. So I think the message I would say to your listeners is you can still be an entrepreneur in this world. Fortune favors the brave. You've got to take the risk. You've got to shoot the content. But find a story that resonates. Find something that you think can entertain or give you joy, like the mowing or whatever it may be. But you've got to be authentic. Because again, back to the, again, what we said about Richard being so good is people see it straight away. If you're trying to be something you're not...
Yeah,
it ain't
going to
work.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
And that's the, you can do it.
Just before we wrap up, as an entrepreneur, Spun Gold's very much still healthy and running. You've got about four or five different companies under an umbrella. What is it?
There's 53 Degrees Global is the parent.
Can I just ask, how did you get to 53 Degrees?
53 Degrees Global is the last student of Liverpool. You see? There you go. So,
brilliant.
So we have, and there's a bit more of a Liverpool theme. So Spun Gold is the traditional... Yeah. Programming, you know, that sort of gardening and lifestyle in that space. Penny Lane, also a little yes. connection, is run by one of my business partners called Lee Conley, and that does Love Your Weekend, but also does the BAFTAs and the sort of the big events and the Queen's 90th and the big live events. Then we have an all-female production company called Love Monday, which yep. is run by a young, sort of very ambitious young female team, and they're very much in the sort of programming for the next generation of women, really. That's yeah. They're smart. So those three are the traditional unscripted spaces. Wise Wolf is our post-production business.
And that's where people can come to you and you will do...
the editing and all that sort of post-production.
And you've got a podcast studio as well, right?
We have a podcast studio. So we set up a social media business called Joy Peddlers,
yeah.
which is... has the podcasts and does all the social media content for people. And then our most recent business... is a company called Mill Bay Media, which is the unscripted drama business, and also for an international broadcaster called The Hairdresser Mysteries. And The Hairdresser Mysteries is about a hairdresser who goes to London as a young girl, and she becomes sort of successful in London. Then she goes back to her northern village and sets up a salon in her northern village. And the hairdresser is played by Sally Phillips from Smack the Pony. She's the best friend in Bridget Jones. And she, Sally Phillips plays the hairdresser. And she sets up a salon. And by day, people tell her their secrets in the salon. And by night, she solves their crime.
Richard has Brilliant. More secrets than you can yeah. imagine.
That sounds great.
And it's the hairdresser mysteries. And it's... that will be on the BBC next year.
Nick Bullen, thank you so much. You have been such a star. We have absolutely loved this. It sounds to me like we're the same age, so we're both 59, is that right? It sounds to me like you've got bags of energy left. Have you got an exit planned? Are you still loving it? Or, you know, are you waiting for someone to come pay you a lot of money to get out of it all? Or what's your plan?
Honestly, it changes on the day. So the reality of it is, if someone would give me a bucket load of cash for 53 Degrees Global.
Yeah, you're off.
I'd love to go.
Yeah.
But I absolutely love what I do. I don't have a proper job. I just don't have a proper job. And I still enjoy coming to work. I get to do amazing things like this. I meet crazy people and do fantastic things. And I'm not sure, you know, a few times people have offered to buy the business and I've nearly sold it. And then it's got to that last point and I thought, what am I going to do?
You're still a bit young,
I can't do it yet. So maybe one day, but at the moment, I love it.
Your two children, are they following you?
No, thank God. The eldest boy is a lawyer, and the youngest one is training to be a lawyer. The youngest one nearly came in, but you know, just in case my business collapses, I intend for them to be my pension, and they will look after me.
So, Nick, the question we ask all of our guests, it's quite a difficult one, but there's never, nobody ever answers the same. You're Prime Minister for the day. What is the first thing that you change?
That's a really hard question. What would I change? I mean, my initial reaction is because I'm trying to buy a new house, it's getting a stamp duty, but that's probably too small.
What do you think's currently wrong with the country? What would be one of the first things that you could feel that you could get it going again? What would you do?
I mean, I really do, genuinely, it's a serious answer. I think none of the governments in recent years have supported entrepreneurs.
No.
I think there's a real lack of support for small business, for startup. Going back to what Margaret Thatcher
I was thinking
did,
the same.
Is, you know, Margaret Thatcher said to people, you know, you can be whatever you want to be, and how can I help you do this? And what she did was she allowed people to buy their own homes. And I think that was as a boy from Liverpool, had working class grandparents, for them, they never dreamed that they would own their own home. And suddenly they could. Mm-hmm. And that was game changing for them. And I think that's what we need to try on. If I could find the thing that is game changing, that could say to young people, I keep using the phrase, fortune favors the brave, we will give you something to let you try and start your business. You know, that young boy that wants to open his salon, that young boy that wants to be a TV producer, you know, the young woman that wants to build her own building construction firm, how do we help them kickstart?
It's hard to comprehend the lack of insight. And that's what I can never get my head around, is that the lack of actually connecting the dots, that the entrepreneurs create business, create drive, create jobs, that in turn delivers land sites and housing, that in turn delivers the future industrial locations that need to be creating or created for future trade and industry. Prime Ministers need to actually put into works. What absolutely floors me is we've got people in government that repeatedly get in, that somehow we are voting in, that have no entrepreneurial vision, insight, conceptualized, you know, structure as to how they're going to get from A to B.
The three of us have started from nothing.
Yeah.
Absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
And unless you're some tech whiz or something like that, you can maybe do it that way. But I mean, the true entrepreneur from the way we started, flying by the seat of your pants.
Yeah, Margaret Thatcher had that line that she said, people used to come into politics to do something. Mm-hmm. Now they're coming into it to be something.
Yes.
And I think that's the fundamental problem. You know, you don't want to come in to be somebody. You need to do something. And
no.
I think you've got to have, I feel very strongly, you're absolutely right, that the people who are in government need to have had some form of life experience. You can't have just come through a political research vehicle and then suddenly find you're the MP and then suddenly find you're Prime Minister. You know, where is that sort of small business knowledge within government?
But also I think you can hear the ones that are constantly saving their job, and that alters their entire voice. They're not acting on behalf of the greater good of the country. They're acting on the greater good of themselves, and it's very
absolutely
evident. And I hate it.
That's absolutely true.
Well, Nick Bullen, honestly, you are a true entrepreneur. Thank you so much, Nick Bullen, for coming on Entrepreneurs Worldwide. You have been an absolute pleasure. And I know that everybody who is going to listen and watch this show will be absolutely inspired by your story, as have we been.
So thank you so much for your honesty.
Thank you for having me.
Can you do us a favour? Can you hit that follow and subscribe button? You can find us anywhere where you get your podcasts on Entrepreneurs Worldwide. And there'll be a new episode every Wednesday at 5 a.m.